Headlines. Britain steps up its rhetoric against Iran just one day before a new round of talks between Tehran and other JCPOA signatories in Vienna. The British opposition Labour Party accuses Prime Minister Boris Johnson of, quote, taking the public for fools amid a row over a leaked video.
Millions of people now think the Prime Minister was taking them for fools.
Also in the headlines, Angela Merkel's era comes to an end as Germany's parliament elects Social Democrat Olaf Scholz as the new chancellor. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. Secretary of State has admitted that Washington made a terrible mistake by unilaterally pulling out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Antony Blinken said that Iran escalated its nuclear activity as a result of the U.S. withdrawal. He also touched upon Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the accord. The top American diplomat said, quote, "The runway is getting very, very short for negotiations, given Tehran's technological advances." Meanwhile, Britain warned that negotiations in the Austrian capital are the last chance for Iran to sign up to the JCPOA. That's a day before a new round of talks in Vienna. Iran says it will only return to full compliance with the agreement if the U.S. removes all sanctions verifiably. Political commentator Mostafa Khoshesh joined us earlier with his take on the latest developments regarding the talks between Iran and the P4+1 group in Vienna.
Iran is under the JCPOA, is a signatory, and is still in the nuclear deal, along with Russia, China, and even the three European nations, including the UK, that have never complied with the undertakings because they are afraid of the U.S., and they may not exercise independent sovereignty in their foreign decisions. The U.S. is outside, and it dropped out of the nuclear deal very formally and, of course, irresponsibly in an illegal manner. Even it didn't go for the mechanism displayed and envisioned in the JCPOA. Well, these threats are normal. That's a worn-out tactic of the Western governments. Like the last week that UK Foreign Secretary, the same, Mrs. Tusk, went for hostile positions against Iran in a joint article with the Israeli regime. They are trying to make Iran budge. Iran is not, to the best of my knowledge, and assessments, and the familiarity with the case, as well as some, the policy, the overall strategy of the Islamic Republic, is not going to budge. It will stay on this course and very firmly defend its drafts. It seems to be lacking credibility, these threatening remarks.
Yemen's deputy foreign minister says some senior commanders of the Saudi-led coalition have announced their readiness to join the Yemeni resistance. Hussein al-Aziz said the contact of senior commanders with Sana'a is yet another sign of the collapse of the coalition that was formed to wage a war in Yemen. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the battle for liberating Ma'arib is approaching crucial hours. Yemeni media say the army and allied popular committees fighters have already managed to liberate the Al-Balkh, Al-Sharqi mountain range near the city of Ma'arib. According to the report, the army has given those who have not yet surrendered last chance to settle the situation. The Yemeni army is dealing simultaneously with Saudi-backed militias inside the country, as well as Saudi-led bombings and shelling that have killed tens of thousands of people since 2015. Israeli settlers have chopped dozens of olive trees in a Palestinian village south of the occupied West Bank city of Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil. According to Palestinian media, dozens of settlers thronged an olive farm belonging to a Palestinian farmer and chopped 70 trees there. Reports say the settlers also let their herd of sheep graze on agricultural lands, destroying crops. Settler violence against Palestinian farmers has been on the rise in recent months. B'Tselem, an Israeli NGO, says the regime informally uses settler violence against Palestinian farmers as a tool to push them out of their lands. The British Prime Minister has been grilled in Parliament over a video in which his senior aides were found joking about holding a Christmas party at Downing Street in 2020.
Millions of people now think the Prime Minister was taking them for fools.
Yeah.
And that they were lied to.
Yeah.
They're right, aren't they?
In a heated exchange with Boris Johnson in the House of Commons, the leader of the opposition Labour Party also said the Premier had been caught red-handed. Johnson apologized over the video, but said that he had been assured that no party was held at his official residence during last year's Christmas lockdown. Johnson also vowed an internal probe into the claim and said disciplinary action will be taken if rules are found to be broken. The video obtained by ITV has caused outcry among Britons who were barred from public gatherings during the last Christmas season. Said Puri is a correspondent joining us from London. So tell us exactly what this controversy is all about, Said.
Hello, Kaveh. This is, as you said, about whether or not a party, a Christmas party, took place at Downing Street, really at the height of the pandemic, where, at least in England, in London, we had the so-called Tier 3 lockdown, where gatherings of just a few people indoors, if they were not members of the same family, were not allowed. And it's been a week since this revelation, when the story was first broken by the Daily Mirror newspaper, and now we're hearing from the government really casting doubt on whether or not it happened at all. And just a week ago, the Prime Minister was said, I assure you that all the protocols were observed. The health secretary as well, saying that she was assured that all the protocols and the guidelines were met, but that cannot be true, given the fact that the timing of it all really shows that the party, if it took place, should not have taken place. And there is videographic evidence of it, isn't there? Aired by ITV, members of the government or staff at Number 10 rehearsing how to respond to the press and the media in the event of the story breaking out into the open. There's also multiple sources saying that there was another party held on the 27th of November. We understand, was a goodbye party, a leaving party for an aide to the former top aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummings. And we all remember the Dominic Cummings controversy when he broke the lockdown guidelines or rules by traveling hundreds of miles outside of London. So what people are saying really at this point is this is yet another case of one rule for us and one rule for the rest of the people, Kevin.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Said Purezadeh, other correspondent from London. Many thanks, Said. Tensions continue to simmer between Russia and some NATO members. Britain is the latest to issue a warning to Russia, saying that it would be a strategic mistake if Moscow launched an invasion on Ukraine. The British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss also called on Russia to respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. This comes one day after the U.S. President Joe Biden, in a virtual summit with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, expressed concern over Russia's troop buildup near Ukraine. Both Washington and London have warned Moscow of severe economic sanctions if Russia attacks Ukraine. Kiev and its Western allies accused Russia of preparing for a large-scale military offensive against Ukraine. Moscow has rejected the accusation, saying that it is NATO that is infringing upon Russia with an eastward expansion. Moscow argues that the country needs to boost its military to protect itself. Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, putting an end to Angela Merkel's 16-year reign. Scholz took the oath of office after being nominated by President Frank-Walter Steinmeier for chancellor. Earlier, lawmakers in the lower house of parliament endorsed his chancellorship by a clear majority. Scholz is a center-left social democrat, leading a three-party coalition with the Greens and the Liberal Free Democrats. He served under Merkel as finance minister and has pledged to continue her policies to make Germany fairer and greener. Merkel is the first German chancellor to step aside of her own accord since World War II. Political commentator Paolo Raffone says the new German government may need to make compromises with other European governments to maintain the country's political and economic dominance on the continent.
Well, first of all, the we can say the miracle that Merkel made to hide under a European carpet the German national interest will be difficult to be pursued in the future. So the government of Scholz will need to make a lot of compromises, more of what Merkel did with the other European nations. And the bilateral treaties that we see, they are flourishing, like the last one between France and Italy, is just signaling this. So the problem of Germany is that it's difficult to define what really Germany wants. German people, we are aware of the fact that the people of Germany want to have stability and basically keep the status quo of the situation that they have lived over the past 16 years. But it is difficult that this can be achieved in the current international situation and within the EU without specific compromises. If Germany wants to keep the position of economic leader, has also to be able, must also consider the possibility to give something to the other nations. Cannot just be the one gaining and the others being excluded from a sort of distribution of this gain. The point is that Germany as such doesn't have a clear geopolitical strategy. Therefore, it is very weak if we see it in geopolitical terms. And it will probably remain so even with the new government.
European Union health ministers meet in Brussels to discuss rising COVID-19 cases and growing pressure on the bloc's health services. Vaccine hesitancy is being singled out as the driving force behind hospital admissions, deaths, and new restrictions. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Figures have just emerged which show that less than 55% of the population in six EU nations have received a COVID-19 vaccine, despite plenty being available. Experts say vaccine hesitancy is the main reason behind rising coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, deaths, and the reintroduction of restrictive measures across the 27-country bloc. EU health ministers have been meeting in Brussels to take stock of the crisis. So is this not a massive failure from the EU? Should the EU not be putting much more of its effort into trying to convince people to take the vaccines?
The EU citizens have moved forward, and we have over 66% of the total population vaccinated and 77% of the adult. But we mustn't stop.
Growing pressure on hospitals means that non-COVID patients are being neglected, and those without private health insurance are falling between the cracks.
Our member organisations are reporting on a daily basis of some of the barriers to access to healthcare, increasing co-payments, difficulties in accessing medicines, specialists, etc. This simply cannot go on.
As EU health ministers met on Tuesday, so too did the bloc's finance ministers. The message was both old and new risks to the EU economy are materialising.
Notably, the growing case numbers and reintroduction of restrictions, global supply chains, and the rise of inflation.
Bulgaria and Romania stand out as having the lowest vaccination rates in the EU. Fears over new variants have been heightened by the Omicron mutation. At the start of the pandemic, EU nations closed their borders and turned their backs on Italy, which was buckling under the pressure. It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical supplies. It's a story the bloc's leaders never talk about. In a veiled reference to it here, health ministers say there must be better cooperation between member states when the next crisis emerges. Jerome Hughes at the Council of the EU, Brussels.
The Turkish lira has been weakening to record lows against the US dollar. Officials blame foreign powers in the lira crisis, saying lowering their interest rates is not the reason behind the crash in the value of the currency. Russian Saglam has more from Istanbul.
Turkish lira continues to lose its value against the US dollar. The lira lost 45% of its value since the beginning of this year and became one of the world's worst performing currencies. People blame the Turkish government for its decision to lower interest rates. But the government blames what it calls foreign plots against Turkey to weaken its economy and, quote, bring the country to its knees. Turkish Vice President Fuat Oktay said the fluctuations in the exchange rates has nothing to do with lowering the interest rate, assuring that Turkey will manage to solve this crisis soon.
Manipulatif hareketlerle kurun yeniden yükselmesine neden olan
these manipulation attempts have an increasing cost not only on us, but also on those who direct it. Such attempts by those who want to bring our country to its knees through the economy will fail.
Oktay explained that Turkey's geographical location and the flexible production provides important opportunity for Turkey to become one of the new production centers in the world. Analysts, however, think this is one of the reasons why this economic war is being waged against Turkey.
Türk hükümeti Türkiye ekonomisine hedef alan sistematik bir planın içinde mi derseniz, evet içinde.
There is a systematic pressure by foreign powers on Turkish economy. This pressure is done, unfortunately, by countries who we consider allies like the U.S. This economic war against our currency is done to put pressure on Turkey and force it to adopt projects and foreign policies that work with their plans in the region. They are opposed to an independent Turkey, and economy is the best way to hit. However, I'm positive that Turkey will be able to solve this crisis soon.
For the past 2 years, Turkish currency has been losing its value due to several reasons, including the coronavirus pandemic, the government's lowering of interest rate, Ankara's tensions with the United States and the European Union. Turkish government and analysts seem positive that Turkey will overcome this crisis. However, looking at the facts and the history of Turkish lira, this seems to be highly unlikely. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Thousands of people are without power in the wake of a powerful storm that has battered the U.S. state of Hawaii. Torrential rains and flooding downed power lines in the state capital, Honolulu, on Tuesday, cutting off power to about 4,500 people. Authorities say the outage will continue until tomorrow. Heavy rains brought at least a foot of water in some areas, flooding houses and roads. A state of emergency is now in place. The Honolulu Fire Department says it responded to more than 90 calls during the storm, rescuing several people. No deaths have been reported so far. Forecasters expect drier weather for Wednesday. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Your Omicron variant contains a new pattern of mutations to its spike protein. These changes could disrupt the ability of some, but probably not all, of the antibodies induced by the current vaccines to bind to the spike protein. If that happens, the vaccines could be less effective at preventing people from getting infected by and transmitting the Omicron variant. We now present you an article written by Deborah Fuller, Professor of Microbiology at the School of Medicine, University of Washington. The piece is titled, How Soon Will Omicron Vaccines Be Ready? Omicron variant of the coronavirus is different enough from the original variant, it's possible that existing vaccines won't be as effective as they have been. If so, it's likely that companies will need to update their vaccines. Deborah Fuller is a microbiologist who has been studying mRNA and DNA vaccines for over two decades. Here she explains why vaccines might need to be updated and what that process would entail. 1. Why might vaccines need to be updated? Basically, it's a question of whether a virus has changed enough so that antibodies created by the original vaccine are no longer able to recognize and fend off the new mutated variant. Coronaviruses use spike proteins to attach to ACE2 receptors on the surface of human cells and infect them. All mRNA COVID-19 vaccines work by giving instructions in the form of mRNA that directs cells to make a harmless version of the spike protein. This spike protein then induces the human body to produce antibodies. If a person is then ever exposed to the coronavirus, these antibodies bind to the coronavirus's spike protein and thus interfere with its ability to infect the person's cells. The Omicron variant contains a new pattern of mutations to its spike protein. These changes could disrupt the ability of some, but probably not all, of the antibodies induced by the current vaccines to bind to the spike protein. If that happens, the vaccines could be less effective at preventing people from getting infected by and transmitting the Omicron variant. Two, how would a new vaccine be different? Existing mRNA vaccines, like those made by Moderna or Pfizer, encode for a spike protein from the original strain of coronavirus. In a new or updated vaccine, the mRNA instructions would encode for the Omicron spike protein. By swapping out the genetic code of the original spike protein for the one from this new variant, a new vaccine would induce antibodies that more effectively bind to the Omicron virus and prevent it from infecting cells. People already vaccinated or previously exposed to COVID-19 would likely need only a single booster dose of a new vaccine to be protected not only from the new strain, but also other strains that may be still in circulation. If Omicron emerges as a dominant strain over Delta, then those who are unvaccinated would only need to receive 2 to 3 doses of the updated vaccine. If Delta and Omicron are both in circulation, people would likely get a combination of the current and updated vaccines. 3. How do scientists update a vaccine? To make an updated mRNA vaccine, you need 2 ingredients: the genetic sequence of the spike protein from a new variant of concern, and a DNA template that would be used to build the mRNA. In most organisms, DNA provides the instructions for making mRNA. Since researchers have already published the genetic code for the Omicron spike protein, all that's left to do is make a DNA template for the spike protein that will be used to produce the mRNA part of new vaccines. To do this, researchers mix DNA templates with synthetic enzymes and form molecular building blocks that make mRNA. That is G, A, U, and C for short. The enzymes then build an mRNA copy of the DNA template, a process called transcription. Using this process, it only takes minutes to produce a batch of mRNA for vaccines. Researchers then place the mRNA transcripts within fatty nanoparticles that protect the instruction until they are safely delivered into cells in your arm. 4. How long until a new vaccine might be ready? It takes only 3 days to generate the DNA template needed to make a new mRNA vaccine. Then it would take about a week to produce sufficient doses of the mRNA vaccine for testing in the laboratory, and another 6 weeks to perform the preclinical tests on human cells in test tubes to make sure a new vaccine works as it should. So within 52 days, scientists could have an updated mRNA vaccine ready to plug into the manufacturing process and begin producing doses for a human clinical trial. The trial would likely require at least another few weeks for a total of around 100 days to update and test a new vaccine. While that trial is going on, Manufacturers could start switching their current process to making a new vaccine, ideally once the clinical trial is complete, and if the vaccine gets authorized and approved, a company could immediately start rolling out doses of a new vaccine. 5. Does an updated vaccine need full clinical trials? It's currently not clear how much clinical data would be required to get FDA approval or authorization for an updated COVID-19 vaccine. However, all the ingredients would be the same in a new vaccine. The only difference would be a few lines of genetic code that would ever so slightly change the shape of the spike protein. From a safety perspective, an updated vaccine is essentially identical to the already tested vaccines. Because of these similarities, clinically testing may not need to be as extensive as what was needed for the first-generation COVID-19 vaccines. At a minimum, clinical trials for updated vaccines would likely require safety testing and confirmation that an updated vaccine induces antibody level on par with the response of the original vaccine against the original Beta and Delta strains. If these are the only requirements, then researchers would enroll only hundreds, not tens of thousands of people to obtain the clinical data needed. One important thing to note is that if vaccine manufacturers decide to update their vaccines for the Omicron variant, it wouldn't be the first time making this kind of change. A previous variant, the B1351, emerged in October of 2020 and was sufficiently resistant to then-current vaccines to warrant updating them. Manufacturers quickly responded to the potential threat by developing an updated mRNA vaccine to match this variant and performed clinical trials to test the new vaccine. Fortunately, this variant did not become the dominant strain. But if it had, vaccine manufacturers would have been ready to roll out an updated vaccine. If it turns out that Omicron, or any future variant for that matter, warrants a new vaccine, companies have already completed the dress rehearsals and are ready to meet the challenge.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
eyes on.
Historically, universities were created to satisfy a thirst for knowledge. All over the world, rulers established knowledge academies for society to benefit from scholarly expertise generated in these institutions. And now, universities have an innate discovery. Their professors write leading research, and their scientific breakthroughs have revolutionized industries. Universities have contributed to health and medicine, which has sometimes literally stopped epidemics and saved lives. With this in mind, and universities would make for excellent...
Welcome to another edition of Supports the Development. See why research is so important in the growth of industries. Stay with us as we uncover how the higher education system is contributing to the expansion of the national economy. Time to check out today's Bazaar.
To get more insight on how universities support development of technology, we visited one in the capital city, Tehran. Islamic Azad University, Northern Tehran Unit, has been around for decades. Each year, some 40,000 students matriculate in bachelor's, master's, and PhD programs. Academia shares the entrepreneurial drive for discovery and innovation. So, this university adopted a program for the development of technology and engineering, which is called the Roche Center. It is a growth center that manages and operates dozens of academic incubators. The program not only supports student innovation and entrepreneurship, but also provides services to knowledge-based companies for research and development. This platform receives support and oversight from the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology and the National Innovation Fund. The main goal in developing this program is to find technological solutions for various needs of the country. For example, the outcome of a research project conducted here was the formulation of a medicine used to treat COVID-19 infections. There are 40 core projects currently in incubation here, and the center has collaborations in many fields of the industry. It is able to stay present in innovative technology arenas by directly using academic research and potentials of its students.
Now, the advantage of growth programs, such as the one we just mentioned, is that it creates a network between students, research and knowledge-based firms. Most essentially, it joins the puzzle pieces of knowledge, tools and funds together needed for manufacturing innovative products. This helps create new and advanced products that might not exist in the market or need to be further developed for industries.
The center offers important facilities for scientific studies. It houses a large and highly equipped laboratory complex for advanced research. The lab provides services and equipment to 6 departments at the university, such as biochemistry and biology. The lab complex has many functions. One is to provide research facilities to students in master's and PhD programs in various sciences. Here, students who have graduated are also employed to conduct research brought in from outside knowledge-based companies. The other function of the lab is to provide a constructive link between university research and industries. For example, knowledge-based companies that produce pharmaceuticals can conduct their research and development at the highly equipped workshops. Research at this lab has helped companies produce many vital products that were previously imported. It might be interesting to know that researchers here adhere to strict national and international standards for product quality and safety. This is a critical step for startups or knowledge-based companies who want to commercialize products they have developed. This center was developed in response to the US sanctions. It has manufactured several products and advanced technology to satisfy the needs of Iranians during the period of sanctions. Some of these products are widely used in the medical sector.
Each Each university in the country has a growth program that supports the entrepreneurship and innovation of students and some businesses. These centers transform creativity and scientific research into products available in the market. In a nutshell, academic incubators are one of the tools used for economic growth. So, what is the government doing to strengthen research and expand the knowledge-based economy?
In 2016, Iran had five times more higher education centers than most developed countries in the world. At that time, there were some 2,640 higher education centers combined. By comparison, this number was just 40 units less than China, which is the most populous country in the world. That's all according to the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology. The ministry began implementing a nationwide plan to reorganize and aggregate higher education centers last year. Under this plan, small-scale academic establishments are aggregated into a network and operated under the auspices of major universities. This saves the country millions of dollars, and educational institutions are able to share financial and educational resources. This scheme carries many benefits. First, it helps academic institutions increase the quality of education and expand the reach of academic incubators. And second, it helps the government and higher education centers efficiently allocate funds and resources to develop focused programs for research. R&D funding is also an investment in regional innovation ecosystems that leads to advanced technology production needed in industries. There are around 3.5 million students in Iran, and increasing the number of graduates has an overall positive effect on high-tech employment in the long run.
Universities play an important role in determining a region's capacity for innovation and transforming new ideas into economic activity. They educate the local workforce, which creates human capital and produces intellectual property. Universities also indirectly contribute through their research activities, which other businesses can use to make commercial value. These foundational research activities help create and advance industries in many ways.
For example, the medical sector is one that has greatly benefited from advanced technology developed by universities and research-based firms. 56% of medical equipment available in the world market in 2018 had Iranian versions. That was based on figures from the National Medical Device Directorate. Some of these items were also on the US sanctions list. These products were developed domestically and produced along the lines of international standards, allowing them to compete in markets abroad. Another advantage of indigenizing advanced medical equipment was reducing costs and dependence on imports. Based on the National Medical Device Directorate, Iran currently exports its medical products to 54 countries across the world. In 2018, the domestic market for these items was estimated to be worth nearly $3 billion.
For millennia, Iranian scholars have actively contributed to advancing knowledge in science and technology. And today, Iran is part of the fast pace at which technological innovation is developing using knowledge-based research. Energy-efficient light bulbs or COVID-19 testing kits are just some of the knowledge-based products that you might be familiar with. Iranian knowledge-based companies have brought many social and economic advantages for people and generating billions of dollars in revenues from its product. We wanted to see how an idea can be transformed into a marketable specialized product and how we'll uncover how they have contributed to the economy. Enough said, let's walk through today's Bazaar. Our journey began at a company that works closely with the Islamic Azad University of Iran, Virajin Akam. Was first established in 2008 and specializes in making technology for analyzing genes and viruses.
Its main products are panel H kits and devices used in medical laboratories. Currently, it has commercialized two of its products for virus detection tests. As part of its vision for the future, this knowledge-based company is looking to expand its product list to include molecular analysis kits for cancer cells. The production unit incorporates the latest technology while including the highest quality of raw material. This company uses in-depth scientific research and know-how, which is carried out by expert staff to manufacture its high-tech products. It has received its production licenses from the Ministry of Health and Medical Education and obtained international standardization certifications too. This means its products, while matching national standards, also adhere to international regulations, allowing them to easily compete in global markets. This company produces 20 different types of kits and a variety of diagnostic kits as well. The production facilities are capable of producing thousands of testing kits per week. There are numerous opportunities for investment in such a company, particularly as it is already standing on the threshold of exporting its products.
As you might know, medical testing kits are very sensitive items which need to be dependable and accurate. Their continuous accuracy is the most important aspect of their use. A lot of science and research goes into making these products, which are the tools doctors use to help patients. For this reason, quality assurance is key in being able to market these items.
The heart of this company is its highly equipped quality control division. Here, all products are tested for performance and accuracy in each stage of production. This includes testing the raw material used to make these kits. This department is essential for maintaining quality and manufacturing items with zero failure rates. But that's not all. The quality control unit is also home to the research and development department. One of the activities at this department is to reverse engineer certain items, such as kits used for the study of genetics, which are currently imported. One of the competitive advantages of this company is that it manufactures medical devices that were previously imported. Indigenizing these items has saved the medical sector millions of dollars from capital flight. Another advantage of this knowledge-based company is its link to the Islamic Azad University's Technology Development Center, meaning the research and development division of this company is able to directly benefit from scientific advancements and services provided by the academic institution. This company has faced numerous challenges over the years, but its trump card has always been its uniquely progressive approach to development. The US sanctions have marginally impacted businesses in this field by hampering international money transfers. This knowledge-based company views the sanctions as an opportunity to strengthen production, filling the market void while reducing the country's dependence on imports.
Research driven by scientific inquiry plays a significant role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. Academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and marketable products, and several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
The company we discussed earlier is an example of a knowledge-based company that was born from the support of a growth program at the Islamic Azad University. The program is called Roshd Center, and its main activity is to incubate startups and entrepreneurship. The center is a platform that supports the creation and developments of new businesses in the field of advanced technology development as they start up. It provides services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully implement their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. These services include offering workspace facilities and managerial, technical, and legal consultations. Usually, startups are incubated at this center for around 3 to 5 years. These centers serve as a type of technical infrastructure and offer a framework for sustainable business growth. The incubators also pursue broader goals, such as regional economic growth, and diversify the economy and investors. It also provides assistance to women and society's minorities in their entrepreneurial endeavors. The advantage of a university incubator is its upfront link to live research and the most recent discoveries. It is a place where scientific advancement directly meets technology development. Azad universities have some 400 campuses nationwide and hundreds of thousands of students enrolling annually. Each campus is equipped with a Rosht Center. For example, the North Tehran unit has 22 projects currently incubating.
But universities aren't the only place where incubators are found. Science and technology parks are also another area that offer similar services to knowledge-based startup and technology-developing businesses. Many of their products are presently streamlined into the market and are also exported to destination markets abroad.
Tech parks are another place where advanced technology is developed for various industries. Based on figures from the Ministry of Research, Science and Technology, there are 42 tech parks and 186 incubators spread across the country. The number of knowledge-based companies has steadily increased over the years. If there were 50 high-tech firms in 2013, now there are 125 times more than that number in 2021. Right now, there are over 6,200 high-tech firms and knowledge-based companies nationwide. Many of these businesses are active in the field of information and communication technology, machinery equipment, and electronic products. Plus, a large number of the companies are actively producing medical devices and pharmaceuticals. Last year, tech and knowledge-based firms raked in over $5 billion in internal revenues. That's according to statistics from Iran's National Innovation Fund. The Science and Technology Office of the Vice Presidency estimates exports of these products will generate $1 billion in foreign revenues by the end of the year. High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. And nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Data from the International Web of Science shows Iran was globally ranked as 16th in 2019 for its citation work. All things considered, Iran's tech ecosystem is flourishing. Several industries have benefited from indigenized technology that has facilitated big advancements productions.
Well, it is time for me to take a break while I pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
EPC is the alphabet of development in each country. It stands for engineering, procurement, and construction. Well, I'm here to spell it out by example. A case in point is this Iranian mega firm that has a long list of accomplishments in the EPC services, not only in Iran, but beyond. Let's take a tour around it.
Farah Tahriq Sepahan, shortly known as SBR, is a private EPC company that offers specialized consultations in a variety of fields, such as mining, steel, and environment. The company is based in Iran's central city of Isfahan. The company has under its belt a young but dedicated team of 200 experts who specialize in a range of fields, including civil engineering, electrical engineering, and mechanical engineering. Thanks to such a team, SBR says it has lived its big dreams.
Big names are known for their accomplishments, and SBR is no exception. Beside its long track record in different key industries, such as oil and gas, it has a lot to say when it comes to dolomite and lime kilns. When it comes to the domestic market, SBR is a household name now. But the ambitious company looks into farther perspectives and seeks to find a foothold in the global market.
SBR has so far worked with heavyweight EPC firms in the world, such as Mears, Daniele, Kutotech, Shizaki, and Ashton Balk, among others. But this is not where the ambitious company stops, as it tries to stand out on the global stage. With 25 years of experience, SBR says one of the secrets to its growth is its constant effort to keep abreast of the fast-growing technology.
SBR says its continued success over more than two decades of experience is built on one simple basis: passion for improvement, something which keeps the ambitious company on track toward even higher horizons.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Now it's time to dive right into some news and trends in Iran's high-tech industry to get more insight. The government has been implementing policies and measures to help support entrepreneurs develop their high-tech products. Now, this effort has paid off, as the Patent Office says it saw a rise in registrations of new inventions.
So far, 160 patents were registered on reputable international offices. That's according to the Patent Office of the Vice Presidency of Sciences and Technology. The National Patent Office says more than 2,100 inventors submitted their patent applications this year. Of this number, over 300 applications have been published in patent offices abroad.
More and more tech parks are sprouting up nationwide as Iran strengthens its tech ecosystem. And Kermanshah province has joined the efforts by launching a first-of-its-kind vertical tech park.
Most tech parks are spread across several hectares of land, but this one is a tower that reaches for the stars in Kermanshah city. The tower has a footprint of 20,000 square meters in 16 floors and is considered the largest tech tower in the country. Its sister tower will be constructed in the near future. The project is an innovation center that houses hundreds of incubators, startups, and other knowledge-based firms.
And last but not least, an Iranian knowledge-based firm builds a wearable robot that helps people with disabilities mobilize their legs.
The ExoPad exoskeleton is a robot fitted to the body and helps the user walk, sit, and stand up. The smart device is meant to replace the wheelchair, but it can also be used as a wheelchair too. The maker of the high-tech medical device offers it in two versions, which can be used in clinics as well as for personal daily mobility.
Well, that covers our program for today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.